If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 191, or 192. We just blew past it. We're 191. We just recorded a few minutes ago. We have to kind of plan ahead. But one of the things that we're going to entitle the show FinTech, because we're going to talk about finance, and part of it's going to be traditional finance, but part of it also is why this traditional finance doesn't need to happen, or traditional banking, or whatever you want to call it, because there's technology out there that's already doing its job. And so I kind of want to start this off with, I know this is a big talking point and push button with Matt, which is, why is the U.S. Postal Service getting into banking? Now, I've read arguments for why they're doing it. I guess it's something that's not entirely new. The Postal Service used to sell bonds and things like that, you know, back like in the olden days, like before and after the Civil War. and actually, if you read the article, I'll read this to you. This is actually from a slash dot post. But in 1947, more than 4 million Americans owned $3.4 billion in savings deposits held not by a bank or credit union, but by the U.S. Postal Service. It's largely a forgotten part of American banking and postal history that the U.S. Postal Service ran postal savings system for 56 years from 1911 to 1967. To this day, postal services around the world provide small-scale financial services from check cashing to savings accounts to e-commerce solutions, such as allowing refunds for returned goods to be deposited directly into a consumer's postal account. In September, the U.S. Postal Service took the first steps towards restoring its place in Americans' financial lives. At four East Coast post offices, customers can now get paychecks or business checks worth up to $500 cashed for a flat fee of $5.95. What does that end up being? $5.95, it's almost six. Well, it's 0.06%. Because it would be 6% for every $100. You know, if so. Add a zero in front of it, and it's 0.06%. It's not a bad fee. I still think it's a lot, because it's a government agency who already takes your tax dollars but does not run at any kind of close to being profitable. But going back to the article, it says postal banking has the potential to reorient the American financial landscape for the benefit of the most vulnerable. A fifth of Americans are considered unbanked or underbanked, often relying on unscrupulous payday lenders because they lack the week-to-week security to set even a little aside in a traditional account. According to a 2014 U.S. Postal Service report, in 2012 alone, those alternative financial services wrung $89 billion in interest and fees out of the poorest Americans. Postal banking also has a bipartisan pedigree. While it has mostly been a centerpiece of the progressive platforms of Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, it has also been promoted by reformist conservatives as a way to get and keep capital in local communities rather than having it held in the coffers of multinational conglomerates. And finally, an expansion into basic financial services may be essential to the very survival of the U.S. Postal Service, as Amazon and private shipping companies continue to press their advantage. The Postal Service can press its own thousands of locations in every nook and cranny of the country along the broad community trust. I understand the arguments here, you know, particularly when we talk about underbanked, you know, and, you know, the article doesn't say where they got this information from, what that underbanking is based upon. And I don't think it's going to stop people from going to payday lenders, because the problem is unless the Postal Service is going to do payday lending, which means you give them, essentially, you're promising if they'll pay you a week ahead, 2 weeks ahead, 2 days ahead, you're going to give them your check plus a fee. Whereas they're just saying they're going to give a check cashing fee. Well, guess who check cashes up to $500. Actually, they check cash more than $500 is Walmart for a fee. And I think their fee is very similar to the 0.06% that we figured out a few minutes ago. There are other places for underbanking. I think we need to look at some of the systems that they use in Africa where people can't get bank accounts because they don't make enough per week. The underbanked U.S. could use a similar system.
Is this really a problem? I
think this is largely a ploy for the U.S. Postal Service to move into an area where they're not blocked by law. Because remember, when Congress said that they couldn't offer other services back in, I forget when it was, but there is a they passed a law that says, you know, the Postal Service is a Postal Service. You can't do other things, you know, like offer copying services or be like, but, you know, all kinds of places offer free, some of them even offer free payday check cashing.
Get back to me when the Postal Service can deliver the mail.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're raising, you know, we talked about this a few episodes ago. So the Postal Service made the decision, the Postmaster General of the United States made the decision that we're going to raise postal prices, but we're going to not guarantee delivery back to the days of, since the early 70s. So tell me how I'm going to trust my money with the post office. The fact that they're charging a fee to check cash at a government office tells me that this is something we can do because it's within the purview that we haven't been blocked from, and we're going to get into try to take part of this payday cash business away from actual businesses who've been doing this for years and are not gouging consumers.
I guarantee you those businesses
because
better than the Postal Service.
Payday lending is not check cashing.
No, I agree.
Walmart, a lot of businesses, UPS store.
A lot of those payday lenders will also do check
cashing
services.
Yeah, but...
And most of them do it for a fee that's not that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, if you could get 1,000 people in a day on a Friday, just 1,000 at a payday cash to pay half that, so a 0.012% fee on a $500 check, you're going to make a couple, you know, what, $5.95? So you're going to make, you know, about $2.95. A check is a fee to cash that check. And see, they're not telling you that, oh, this also includes checks that are less than $500. So if you have a $100 or $200 check, you're going to pay double or triple or quadruple the percentage for cashing the check. That's, I mean, it's funny how it's written. Well, it's also funny how it says here about they're comparing it check cashing to payday lending. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to help people through payday get out of the cycle of payday lending and owing all the time by cashing checks. And that's not what payday lending fixes.
Agreed. Again, this is just another government service in search of a problem to solve.
Well, again,
rather than
it's not in search of a problem to solve. I'm trying to figure out how I can make more money and not be so much in the red as a government agency by instituting this service, and you can't see all the air quotes Matt and I are doing, the service that charges a fee, which is, what is a fee? A fee is a tax.
Well, when the government does it, any government does it,
yeah.
A fee is a
tax. Yeah.
If a business does it, be it your doctor or a lawyer or whatever, that's just the exchange you make in order to get those services.
Yeah.
But when a government does it,
it's
a tax.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And, you know, how, again, this article is really kind of, well, most articles I found today are very, because where they, this article, it's written in such a way, the language, that it's trying to present facts and trying not to be biased, but it's very biased. Because, again, they're comparing check cashing to payday lending. There's no solution here to show how the Postal Service is going to fix an $89 billion problem in our poorest citizens in the United States through cashing paychecks.
What payday lending does that cash checking does not is provide liquidity
to people who have low have it. Correct, who have low income.
That's
why payday lending, the interest rates are so high, because there's a lot of risk in doing that. And exactly. This is not solving that issue. Now, if the Postal Service and the government want to start doing payday lending, that's totally different. But then again, you have to almost ask, well, why are you doing payday lending? Just cancel all taxes.
Problem solved.
Yeah. And, but, you know, so further on the article, it says this modest pilot is the foundation for a more expansive contemplated postal banking services that could include bill paying services, ATM access, and money order and wire transfer capabilities. Again, Western Union, Walmart.
This is government trying to ultimately nationalize those industries right out of business.
Correct.
That's what they want to do. The problem is government services will never be as good
as the private
sector already is doing these services.
Yeah, no,
I struggle with the BMV as much as anybody. I don't want my health care to be run by the BMV. I don't want my banking services run by the BMV.
Yeah.
Why would we want to do that? There's no...
Well, besides the fact that, I mean, there's already businesses and services out there that do it, and, you know, the fintech, the financial technology that exists, and a lot of it is of the fintech is out there is done to alleviate the underbanked, you know, issues that the underbanked have. So there's several companies out there who have you download an app to your government phone, government issued phone, and you can get a bank account that has no fees. They will do overdraft with no fees up to like a week. So you need to pay a bill. So this is where people get in trouble with payday lending. So my car insurance bill, which gets me to work, is due a week before I get paid. And so I need to cover that. Well, there's several, and they're U.S. controlled companies who they allow overdraft up to a couple hundred dollars. And they charge no fees for like 2 weeks. And some of them don't charge. It depends on the number of transactions. So if you have like 12 transactions, any more overdraft, or it's like 12 transactions or less in a year, they don't charge any fees where you overdraft your account. And now there's a limit to how much money they will allow you to overdraft. But again, what is that? That's not for those of us who get paid on the regular and things like that. That is for the people who make less than $25,000 a year and are considered, you know, our poorest members of the United States, and, you know, where traditional banks don't help them. You know, you overdraft at U.S. Bank or somewhere else, and they want to charge you $125 for the return of the check, $25 for the overdraft, $50 because you can't pay the overdraft back in 2 extra days. You know, I mean. That's what these people are addressing.
There are banks, including U.S. Bank, that are considering dropping all of those.
Almost fees. All the banks are getting ready to drop those fees and allow. And
you know why that is?
Because
competition works.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And the other issue is too, is part of the competition that the banks are facing are these new fintech companies who are doing this, but also some of the traditional fintech companies like PayPal, who have found a way to essentially be a bank without being a bank. And what's the other one? I don't use them because they use a distributed ledger that's public, but a lot of people like it.
Like the Cash App or...
Well, not Cash App. That's another one that does it. Venmo. Yes. Venmo. A lot of people like Venmo. But again, those have traditionally, PayPal originally did not do that. You had to have a bank account or a credit card to tie to PayPal. But now you can create a PayPal account, and if people pay you, they hold your money and you can spend it. I have a PayPal debit card that I can use to spend the money out of my account, and they issue those to people now as a traditional card. And so they did that because Venmo was allowing people to transfer money back and forth and now pay for goods and services. Crypto has started doing this. People who have cryptocurrency, it allows them. You know why the U.S. There's two reasons the U.S. Postal Service is doing this. Part of it is U.S. Postal Service is in trouble. They need to close. I mean, if I were running the Postal Service like a business, which I am, don't get me wrong. I've worked both for the government and in the private sector as an officer in a business, somebody who commanded, and in the government, I commanded a multi-million dollar budget. The issue is the government looks as money as renewable resource. The Postal Service is considered a, air quotes again, a quasi-governmental agency. They tried to spin it off so that it would be, it would make its own money. But the problem is that the post office does a really crappy job on what they do. They're the lowest common denominator. And when you have businesses like UPS and FedEx who are highly competitive with each other, you know, and can guarantee delivery. And that's the big issue. People are willing, if you have to have something delivered, people are willing to pay the money to get it delivered when they need it delivered. You know, what day can this be delivered on? UPS and FedEx will both tell you it'll be delivered on Tuesday. If you're sending this Saturday, they'll say it'll be delivered Tuesday before 4 p.m. Postal Service, you go in and you pay for U.S. priority mail, and they're like, well, it's supposed to be 2 days, but it might not get there until Friday. But then again, it might not get there till Monday. You know, they play games. And their tracking is a joke. The U.S. Postal Service tracking, when you go in and take their number and you go and you track a priority mail package, it will tell you it's been accepted by the post office. And it will not tell you anything, like it's in transit or anything else, until it's been delivered. I go to UPS and it tells me, oh, yeah, it was shipped from Shanghai, China. It's been through customs. It's now in Incheon, South Korea. And now it's in Fairbanks, Alaska. And in Fairbanks, Alaska, it's gone to West Carrollton, Ohio. And then it's out for delivery. And it says, will be delivered between 2:45 and 4:45 p.m. And guess what? They almost always hit that mark. Almost always. That's what the U.S. Postal Service, but they can't get letters. And so the U.S. Postal Service is the equivalent of physical junk mail to me. In a week's time, I will get maybe two things that are important, like bills that were sent to me, that I also get sent electronically. So I didn't even care that they... And part of the reason they're sent electronically is all of like your utilities, your energy company, your water and all that. They know that the Postal Service is so unreliable that they will let you opt into electronic billing because they want to make sure you get your bill paid on time. Because what happens when your county water system doesn't get your bill? They go turn off your water, but then you go, well, I didn't get the bill until a week after you sent it, you know. what are they supposed to do? Because unfortunately, the post office is stupid enough to stamp it. Oh, but they can't track it. And so there's no justification to say that why isn't there? And so that's why, you know, you get your energy, your electric bill. You might get a physical copy every month, but they also email you that you're, I mean, our county emails me to tell me we've sent our bills out today.
Wow.
But I don't ever look for the bill. I just go log into my account because I always pay everything online. And that's the other thing. People are paying their bills online. Why? Because Postal Service is unreliable. you might send a bill out and it gets lost in the mail. Well, it's hard to do that when you're logging into Duke Energy and you just give them a credit card number and you pay your bill and they give you a credit card confirmation right away. That's why the post office is losing money.
Well, with the advent of the greatest invention of all time, email, there's no reason for the Postal Service to exist.
Correct. Correct. Well, the
package delivery would have been a reason for them to exist.
Yes.
Letters?
Probably not so much.
Not so much.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other thing is the rate of inflation on postage is like 6x, at least in the United States, it is 6 to 10x every other inflationary model. Because those guys, they're government employees. Again, they look at money as a renewable resource. They don't know how to run a business. Like, I'll tell you, and you know, the postal service, it's such a sad thing because it really, in the United States, it was super important. You know, a lot of the roads that were built, particularly out west, were created so that they could deliver mail. So that they were called postal service roads that wouldn't exist. You know, they probably would eventually have existed, but they didn't exist back, you know, in the early 19th century without the Postal Service needing those, because they had, you know, the government had had to deliver mail because that was the only thing, you know, that was a fundamental service of the government at the time. But today, like Matt said, with email, with online electronic payments, the Postal Service is not...
It's no longer a vital service.
No, because... And that's because they're the physical version of junk mail in your inbox, on your email, is they're selling the advertisers, people who are... And they are the low end of the advertising bucket, too. People, they give discount rates to people to send bulk mail, meaning that, oh, in this zip code, you can send, you know, a marketing piece of mail to everybody. And so basically, not only they're contributing to global warming because we're cutting down trees to print all of this crap that, frankly, I don't want to see anyway. I'm going to throw it away. That people throw away. That's the other part. When I go to the mailbox, I throw all the junk mail into a burn bag. Yeah, I don't even open it. You know it's junk mail. And it's gotten so bad, too, with these bulk marketers that they've started... making their junk mail look like legitimate bills because people are not looking at them. But the Postal Service they don't want to lose that amount of business. So they just keep, you know, they keep lowering that bulk mail rate for these folks. So how does that work? So I'm not getting as much money on regular postage, sending letters back and forth to each other, because that's the other thing with cell phones and everything else. People are not communicating with each other via letters anymore. And it's a little sad because writing a letter is kind of a lost art. But, you know, text messages, phone calls, FaceTime, Skype, all of these things have taken over that communication with people locally or, you know, over long distance. You know, I'm not writing a letter to tell you that I lost my foot at the Battle of Valley Forge, you know. And it is sad because it is a part of history, and I think part of the reason.
No, look, it's not sad. This is the way it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Any other ownership group, this business, and that's what the Postal Service is supposed to be.
It's a business.
Supposed to be a business. Would have gone the way of the dodo by now. Creative destruction. That's how it works. You have a product that has a certain life cycle, and when that life cycle ends, you either innovate.
Or you go out of business.
Or you die.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's supposed to work. The Postal Service should die. It shouldn't.
It shouldn't
expand into other services that it's not designed to do.
Yes, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. The thing is, there's simple cost-cutting measures, and it's become political. That's the problem. If the Postal Service really wants to survive, it needs to not be a government agency. They need to spin it off completely and say, you live or die by how much money you make. And that, you know, and get rid of the idea of the Postmaster General and put in somebody who actually has, you know, an ex-exec at UPS or FedEx or, you know, one of these other shipping companies. Because the funny thing is UPS ships a letter. If you want to send a standard letter, it's cheaper to ship it via UPS than it is the Postal Service right now.
Here's why they won't do that. They've got X number of million employees that are now unionized that they can't just let go.
But again,
they're too big to fail.
The problem is, though, if you look at it from a perspective, so there's, according to this article, there's over 34,000 U.S. Post Office locations. You know, during the Trump era, they started closing those locations because I'll give you an example. In the community I live in, we have a full-scale post office and distribution center. In the community next door to me, the adjacent community, I drive a mile and a half down the road, a mile and a half, mind you, and there's another one for that community that's a post office and a distribution center. They could probably save millions of dollars in cost without getting rid of people, because you still need the mail carriers to deliver them, without getting rid of people, if they reduce the overhead, because they don't need 34,000 physical locations, you know? Two communities that are adjacent to each other both don't need a post office. You probably could consolidate six or seven communities. So, you know, you have a 1 in 6 reduction and get rid of the buildings. Keep the employees because you need the postal carriers to still drive everything around. But you're not paying for maintenance of that property. You're not paying, you know, electric and cooling and water and sewage and, you know, all the things that you have to have. That's what a business would do, you know, if they had a whole bunch of that's what... I hate to say it because it's in some respects a unfair comparison, but not off. That's what Sears did. That's what JCPenney is in the process of doing. That's what a lot of stores in the retail sector
That's another thing where creative destruction has taken these brick and mortar stores, and with the rise of Amazon and eBay and online shopping, the country does not need a Walmart every other block.
Correct.
We just don't need it.
Well, and that Walmarts have become regional. You know, and when I say regional, I will say sub-regional. So instead of having a Walmart in every city, you'll have a Walmart that it, you know, covers 3, 4, 5 adjacent communities. You know, a super Walmart. As opposed to having even 2 or 3 Walmarts in those adjacent communities. It depends on what it is. But like, when growing up in Kentucky, every little town, you know, real town, had a Walmart in them. Did they really need a Walmart in every little town? No. You know, what they really needed is they needed a Walmart in this town over here, and then the next community that was adjacent to it, they needed a Kroger, and the next community they were adjacent to it, they needed a Kmart, so that there was a little bit of competition. And that's the problem with the post office. Because they're run as a government agency, they don't think they have competition, when in reality, they're being outdone by private companies.
Well, and not only that, but being outdone by technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but they have failed to innovate.
Yeah, and it's a long string of bureaucrats who've caused that over time. You know, where the Postal Service has invested in technology is in all the things that just processed mail, physical mail, as opposed to going, well, you know, maybe we should look at this, maybe we should do this. But see, again, none of them... All the people who run the post office are bureaucrats. They're not people who've spent their lives working in the private sector, you know, running a retail business. Shipping is a retail business. So.
Well, ultimately, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean,
whether it's a package or a letter or
yeah. Well, and you have to ask since the end of World War II, when has the government really been good at anything? When has it been number one? Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, which we're going to talk about GE in a few minutes, his goal, he wrote a book back in the early 2000s called Winning after he had retired as the CEO of General Electric Corporation. And he talked about the process of, if you're going to be in the market for something, you either need to be number one or number two. Don't be anywhere else. Because at least at number two, you're the one who's coming up and could overtake and become number one. But if you're number three or number four, sell that business off or consolidate it, shut it down, because you're not going to be successful. Now, I don't totally agree with that, but in the case of shipping, U.S. Postal Service is like number nine. And because it's a government agency, we keep taxpayers are footing the bill to run something that is unprofitable. You know, we talk about how unprofitable the IRS is to run. The Postal Service is 10 times more unprofitable than the IRS, which is saying a lot. You know, and it would be one, even if they didn't get rid of the Postal Service, part of the reason you have 34,000 locations is because, you know, back in the 19th century, you know, the most you could move in a day was about 25 miles. That's what a horse would take you. It was about 25 miles, and that's really pushing it. I mean, so you had to have a post office about every 25 miles, you know, and more likely you had to have one probably every 6 or 7 miles.
But if we had one at every 25 miles and not every other mile,
yeah,
we would be in a
better situation than we are today. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, that same adage holds true. If we just, I can understand like Dayton and Cincinnati, big cities, they hold the regional postal services, and those are the hubs where, you know, mail leaves the state and everything else. But, you know, for your local post office, would it really be out of hand with as little as most people use them that you had one post office every 15, 20, 30 miles? Would it really hurt you to drive 30 miles to go to the post office?
And with the advent of the automated teller machine, they're already selling stamps out of those.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be that much of a stretch to have it take a letter.
Correct. Well, I mean, what about the blue mailboxes? Again, if you're just reducing the facilities costs, but you're keeping the employees, they can still go pick up, you know, all the letters and deliver them to the regional facility. It just, you know, it just astounds me what the Postal Service is doing as opposed to what they could do, you know.
But again, it's they're not incentivized to view their business model as being anything other than a government agency.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
You know, if they were
It's funny too, because when you go into the post office and at my local post office, the ladies are very nice who work there, but they're kind of apathetic about everything. They're the slowest moving people. There's no hustle in their gait, and there probably is no incentive for there to be hustle in what they do. And sometimes when I hand them stuff, I'm a little worried because it's they throw them in bins and stuff, and I'm like, is that really the right bin? You know?
Yeah.
Well, let's move on from that. Let's talk about something that, in some respects, for most people will be happy news. So your tax bracket for the 2022 financial year, according to the IRS, they're raising the amount of money you can make in all brackets by 3%, partly due to inflation. I bet you when we get another raise, but they announced that yesterday on Veterans Day, which I think is kind of funny, about this raise in the tax brackets, so that you're in the lower. If you're right on the bubble, it's probably great for you. For most people, it probably won't change anything. It'll just mean you're lower in the tax bracket you're already in, but you're still in the same tax bracket paying the taxes. That's just kind of, again, if we got rid of personal, I understand corporate income tax because companies utilize public services. If they didn't pay corporate income taxes, they would be utilizing public services for private industry for free. I can see paying, but I can't see them paying, you know, exorbitant taxes on that either. Like, we all agree internationally that we're going to have 25% corporate tax. Oh, that's bullshit. Because there'll be some company who or some country who didn't agree for that, and we're going to see them go, well, you can pay us 6%. And then all the corporate headquarters across the world are going to rush to this country with 6%. And that country is going to be flush with cash. And we're going to be going, well, where did all of our corporate tax money go? Because guess what? Corporations have enough money to move stuff. It's just like rich people. People who are billionaires, they don't stay billionaires because their accounting firms don't find loopholes in order to keep as much money as possible. And they don't pay accounting firms exorbitant amounts of money because they want to pay accounting firms exorbitant amounts of money. The money that they save is greater than the money that they're paying the accounting firm. So, again, I know math is hard, but it's math. And it's human nature. So, let's move on to talk about, there's actually two companies who are doing similar things. So General Electric Corporation, which since Jack Welch left in the early 2000s as the CEO, they've had a hard time adjusting to changes in technology, changes in what they're doing. They've sold off a lot of businesses that were unprofitable, but they're splitting into three, and actually Toshiba is following suit. Let's see, in an article in the Sunday Times, they say General Electric's decision this week to split itself into three separate companies followed almost immediately by similar splits by the healthcare and pharmaceuticals group Johnson & Johnson and the Japanese conglomerate Toshiba is the final confirmation of one of these generational changes. So all these companies, these massive companies, and, you know, very likely that will be similar to, we'll see the same thing happen with Procter & Gamble.
Eventually,
is that you'll see these giant corporations who bought all these other brands and businesses and housed them under a single umbrella are going to move off into having separate.
But it kind of depends. Now, P&G, for the most part, their diversification came from the same type of product.
Yes, whereas GE, well,
GE went from like aircraft engines to small electronics to
household appliances to. They had a financing company, which they closed 20 years ago at this point. Their diversification was much different. And Toshiba's is kind of the same. Toshiba's, I have this other article from Toshiba. So Toshiba's breakup, they're splitting into three. So they're going to, theirs are similar companies, though. I mean, that kind of feed one another. It was kind of a supply chain thing for them. So they're splitting their company to an electronics and storage company, a flash memory company, and an infrastructure services company. And all of those are much more closely related because they're all IT related.
Right.
And they're still splitting into three. So, you know, it's interesting what's going on. And I didn't look into Johnson & Johnson and how they're splitting up. But, and if you look at General Electric, they're splitting into... let's see where. I'm looking through the article here. See, Jack Welch was the CEO between 1981 and 2001 of GE. And that's when they grew and became the world's biggest company at the time. So it's spinning off its healthcare unit, which makes hospital equipment, into one of the companies.
Johnson & Johnson or?
GE.
GE.
And and then aviation, which is actually their aviation division is actually the part that's really making a profit. But they're having supply chain issues because of getting those issues, you know, the parts across the world. What's the third one? And it's power division, which is all renewable energy. They're the ones making the big wind turbines, the power division. Because they've already sold off the appliances division, the consumer appliance, you know, that toasters and all that. They sold all that off because there's no money in that anymore.
No.
And they sold off their finance division, all of those like 20 years ago, right after Jack Welch, either during his reign at the end or right after he retired. I think the financial division was the one that they did after he retired, but the other two were prior to 2001 while he was still CEO. Because again, his philosophy was, if we're not number one or number two in that industry, we're not going to stay in that business.
But, now correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't GE expand their diversification into all his different areas under his watch?
Yes, they did. They became the world's largest company under his watch.
So,
but at that time, they were number one or number two in all of those over a 20-year period. You know, or attempting to become number one or number two in that 20-year period. But
I mean, that's like going back to our shipping argument. Are we saying that DHL should just throw in the towel because they're never going to be?
Well, I said I didn't say.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah, I totally agree with his everything he says.
His philosophy.
But I mean, there's also our, like I said, the Postal Service is probably the ninth, you know, number nine in that or 10.
Sure.
In the United States, you know, in other countries, the Postal Service is better.
But if you're not turning a profit and you're not one or two, then
yeah, that was really what he was saying.
If that's his philosophy, then okay, I'm a little more.
Well, you also have to look into that too. Is he was a big proponent of, you have to be number one or number two and be profitable, because stockholders are. That's why he stayed
right so
long as CEO, is because he protected the stockholders. If you're a private company and you're making a profit, but you're number third or fourth in the world, or you know, in a country or region, world, whatever, you're probably okay to be where you're doing, because the only people you're answering to are the owners.
Yeah,
you know. Hence the Sacklers. No. But you know, it's. I look at as you call it, creative destruction. These companies couldn't last forever. It's just, you know, I work in the tech world where you watch companies come and go. If a company has been around since the 70s, which there are very few, Microsoft, Apple, IBM, you know, there's probably a handful more, but those are the big three that have stayed in the IT world and been relevant, you know, since they came together from the late 70s. Well, and IBM's a lot longer than the 70s. But
and IBM really isn't a technology company.
They're a services company now.
Financial services company.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is bizarre, if you ask me.
Well, they don't innovate.
Well, and that's...
They buy companies that have good technologies, and they sell them for a few years, and then they buy other technologies. And so their innovation is through acquisition as opposed to building new stuff. At least Apple and Microsoft build new shit, you know? Is it always good? Nah. It's arguable, but it's not terrible. And at least they, you know, it's their stuff. And when they do... Microsoft, not so much anymore, but Apple definitely. Acquisitions are strategic. I need a piece of technology to incorporate into this other piece of technology that we developed so that we can make a better piece of technology. Microsoft does a bit of that, but they're starting to move into that IBM model of, I'm going to start buying, acquiring new technologies, and I don't necessarily integrate it well with my existing stuff, but that's another story. I don't want to get off in that tangent, but that's definitely relevant to these big companies, Johnson & Johnson, Toshiba, GE. In this article from the Sunday Times, they add a few more. I don't totally agree with some of the ones that they think that are going to happen. They added Ford, General Motors, Boeing, United Technologies, Lockheed Martin, 3M, and Caterpillar. All huge corporations. Ford, they, I think, are adapting well to changes in the market, changes in the technology that's out there. Ford Maverick is the new pickup truck, is a good example of that. Also, they've picked their niche. They, you know, we're no longer making cars. We're making SUVs, which are essentially trucks that are fully enclosed, and trucks, and the Mustang. That's it. We're not making, you know, the Ford Fiesta, which is a subcompact, and we're not making a big sedan. That's what Lincoln, our other brand, does. You know, they're trying to differentiate their brands. General Motors, I can see it. And it, partly the reason I see it is because it's been happening at General Motors for a lot longer. They created Saturn. They closed Saturn. They've closed Oldsmobile. They've closed Pontiac. You know, those brands don't exist. Now, from probably the late 70s to modern times, all of General Motors brands really don't need to be separate brands, because they called them, you know, this is the Y model, and I'm going to make a Cadillac version, and I'm going to make a Buick version, I'm going to make a Chevy version, I'm going to make a Oldsmobile version, and based on the brand name, we're going to change the pricing and the interior and trim packages on them. You know, so we'll charge $60,000 for the Y body as Cadillac, and we'll charge $22,000 as a Y body as a Chevy, you know. And people have caught on to that. So they're more luxurious brands. There's not a lot of differentiation. You know, I can get leather seats in the Cadillac, and I can't in the Chevy, but how many people buy leather seats? Again, I'm making hand gestures you can't see, and Matt's responding with eye gestures you can't see. So, you know, I can see General Motors. I can see Boeing, you know. Boeing is in trouble in many fronts. The whole Boeing 737, was that 700 or 800? Whatever the ones they had to ground because they kept crashing out, falling out of the sky. Which, unfortunately, I have to fly on two of those next week. I don't think it was the 700. It was the 737.
I think it was the 800.
800, yeah.
I think it was. Don't hold me to that. I'm pretty sure it was the
800. Well, if any of you are listening, correct us on...
Yes, please.
Send us an email and correct us. But the... I can see them. They've had issues because it was a huge financial loss and a huge... More so a huge reputational loss for Boeing, and because now it gave a great introduction for, you know, France's Airbus to come in with a lot of U.S. airlines and go, look, we don't have these issues. And so Boeing's got, they have a loss of revenue because of that, which also gave them a loss of revenue on their military side. You know, in developing new aircraft and trying to get the U.S. government to be interested. But
plus, they're still trying to play in the space race too.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Which seems,
it seems kind of, well, I understand it. You know, their diversification is really similar companies. You know, it's all technology that was either aerospace or space. The issue, and shipping, that, you know, they built a lot of logistics systems and equipment that go on commercial shipping vessels and things like that. But, you know, the issue with them is that they're like the old guys who didn't change fast enough. And so in the space race, you know, companies like SpaceX and even Blue Origin are the number one and number two. And there's probably another handful of companies who are up and coming, where Boeing is like the old crowd. There's no way. Boeing was one of the companies who went to NASA and said, there's no way you can make a rocket and land it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so they're out. They're not in the Artemis program. They're not in the SLS program. They're not in the Gateway program. They're, I mean, all these programs, they've lost out to SpaceX and Blue Origin and a couple other space companies. And I mean, they're not the only one. United Launch Alliance. There's a few of them who you know, Boeing's going to have to. They really need to reevaluate their company, and they probably are going to have to split off. And I would assume that they would split along the lines of aerospace and space. You know, and maybe logistics, you know, if they were going to split in three and be three separate companies. And hopefully one of them, you know, Lockheed Martin, you know, which was a combination of Lockheed and Martin Marietta. Same deal. One of the old Beltway bandits told NASA and the U.S. government, you can't land, you can't make a reusable rocket that you can land. And
are you familiar with what McConnell Douglas does? I mean, they're another one of those that...
Yeah, they're similar. They make aircraft in the United States, have for...
Do they still make a whole airplane?
I do not know.
Or are they now just components?
I do not know. I think they're more like GE aircraft. I think they make pieces and parts now. I don't think they've made a full aircraft, at least for the U.S. government, since like the 60s.
That fits with my recollection. I'm still surprised.
I mean, and there's all kinds of companies like... I forget the name of it. I had a buddy who used to work at the company who makes the Ospreys.
Yeah.
And the company who actually makes them is like a subsidiary of another aerospace, well, semi-aerospace company, you know. Because they were bought by another company. And, you know, I think they're going to, this acquisition model of where, because the problem is the both consumers and the government need more competition in these areas. And luckily, like in the space side of things, that was a place where startups could do well because it was so stagnated. The aerospace side is still, it's going to change because aerospace has to change. We got to quit using somebody's, and there are some startups that are innovating who are creating prop planes that travel almost as fast as jets, but use a tenth of the fuel. There's, you know, all kinds of issues related to, you know, making jets and things environmentally friendly, but still moving the same amount of people and materiel everywhere. And so there are companies there. We're just not at the point where they're ready to put out a final product and start winning contracts with commercial carriers. But when they are, you're going to start seeing the same thing happen to the aerospace part of Boeing and McDonnell Douglas. I mean, the competition is big enough anyway, or bad enough for a lot of these folks anyway.
One of the biggest issues in aerospace is the fact that there's no longer a need to build a jumbo jet that's a passenger plane.
Well, you know, that's the thing. A 737, Boeing kind of, I think, screwed themselves up. The 737 is like their middle of the road. It's not like the 747s or the 750s. I don't remember. But they have a newer, bigger one, too. Because it kind of is the right size when you're moving people. And then you add COVID, where we had such a drop, and the 37 is so much easier to operate than the bigger ones, which you have fewer in your fleet anyway, that, you know, we're seeing a shift in what's possible. You know, right now the big issue is because of shipping problems. Airlines are looking at, like, Airbus is converting their A350. They've got a new model coming out that is used to ship material around, you know, packages. And
cargo, you will never get to a point. Maybe we will at some point get to a point, but we're not there yet. We're still seeing boats hanging out in the ocean.
Yeah.
But airplanes will never get to a point where we have a too big of a cargo plane.
No, I don't think so either. Well, the thing is so, like, because there's a backup at the ports, companies are, you know, and they're, I mean, companies like Apple and Microsoft and other fine electronic companies, they're not selling huge items. So you can pack, they, you know, the cargo planes, they pack all the packages securely in cargo cans, and then they load the cans into these planes. And so the cans fill the entire volume of the cargo area, which you can't do with a passenger plane.
Exactly.
And so they're high, they're a lot more efficient in sending cargo than they are people. And the fact that shipping rates on ships have gone up so high, the difference between ship shipping and air shipping is falling to nil. I mean, I just got a brand new MacBook Pro. Woohoo! No, I'm not to brag, but it shipped from China and it shipped via UPS, which is traditional for Apple to use. And guess what? I didn't have to wait. I got it. I didn't have to wait for it. Why? Because they flew it over. And I didn't pay any shipping on it, which means that the differential in price for shipping was probably not enough for Apple to wonder, you know, to change their policy and not offer free shipping. And so I think, you know, with particularly Airbus is moving into that, you know, FedEx's main headquarters is out of Indianapolis, their shipping headquarters. They're headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee. UPS is headquartered in Louisville, Kentucky. They're going to, I think, see a big boom in their profits because of this whole logistics problem. You know, the things that get shipped on ships a lot of times are either low-cost consumer goods, you know, little widgets and all this other stuff that cost pennies to make and cost a dollar or less to sell. Those items get shipped on shipping containers, or big items, washing machines, dryers, things that are bulky and you can't get them as much packed, so there's not as much profit in shipping them via air. But I think even some of that stuff, just because you can't get it, is now becoming priced well enough that offering, you know, flying it across the water is...
That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
I think that the longer this naval system is blocked, I think the aerospace system
is going to pick it up. Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, the other thing is, now what will be interesting is if it ever gets to the point like it did with trains, because frankly, the outside of barges are the cheapest way to ship things across the country, but you're limited to big rivers like the Ohio and the Mississippi to ship things north, south, east, and west. Which, you know, west of the Mississippi, there's not a big river that you can ship barges down. So that makes it a little problematic. But, you know, it could get to the point where, like the train system, which a lot of stuff, cars used to be shipped via train. That was the cheapest way to ship cars from car manufacturing plants across the country was via train. But, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s, almost all train companies got rid of passenger service, partly because airlines took that part away from them and everybody had cars. So they started shipping freight almost entirely. That there's a potential, probably not to the point where their airlines are not going to offer passenger service, but while passenger service is down, that they're going to dedicate more and more of their fleets to cargo service. Because I would. That if I were Delta and Southwest and all these guys, you know, I'd start limiting the number of flights for passenger service and start increasing the number of planes in my inventory that do cargo.
Exactly the point I was trying to make.
Yeah. Because again, other technologies have gotten in and taken the need for face-to-face meetings in a lot of places. You know, we use Microsoft Teams and Zoom and Skype and FaceTime and, you know, you name it. Although I still think those meetings are not quite the same. Partly because when you're on a FaceTime or Zoom or Skype, you know, meeting, it's still hard for people to recognize when another person is talking. And so you get a lot of talk over. And part of that's latency on the network connection. I don't want to go in that either, but so I think we're going to leave it there. Let us know what you think. Please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.